Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here is your host, Sean Graham.
And thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam podcast, everybody. I am Sean Graham. We're coming at you nearly live from Victoria, British Columbia. We're here at the Congress CHA annual meeting. And we're going to talk today a little bit about some of the cuts that the government has been making to historical institutions across the country. And here to talk to us about that, new president of the Canadian Historical Association, Dominique Marshall from Carleton University, and now past president for about 24 hours, Lyle Dick. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you both for doing this. I really appreciate this. And this is a subject that has gotten a lot of attention over the past couple of years, the notion of budget cuts. And it's not just the history. Budget cuts have been happening throughout the government. And it's a concern for a lot of people. So I'm just wondering, as representatives for this first question of the Canadian Historical Association, how is the CHA responding to some of these cuts and how they're affecting institutions like Library and Archives Canada and some of the smaller archives around the country?
There's two things. There's the general idea of cuts, and for that, I think that there is a sense that in general we have to make sure that the public is aware of the importance of history. So that, you know, if there has to be cuts everywhere, there has to be cuts everywhere, but that cultural institutions are not suffering unduly from general cuts. It's more of a larger fight about the importance of humanities, of education, of research. And there we all are part of institutions that are trying to make sure that the importance and the value of history research and teaching and interpretation and communication is well conveyed. So we're doing that through the Federation of Social Science and the Humanities, and we're doing that with relation with other groups that are doing the same thing. But then there is the whole more direct question of cuts in Library and Archives Canada and Museum, the Canadian Museum of Civilization, and on various archival programs and on programs of Canadian studies abroad and on the social science and humanities research council. And for that we are trying to fight for more money for these things, but also when there are cuts, how they are going to be managed. And we want to make sure that the way that these political decisions are thereafter implemented are done the best possible way for the discipline, which means making sure that historians who are working in these places have their say, that these things are done according to the standards of the discipline, and to monitor how they are done and to make sure that we are listened to. And we've made representation for every single one of these institutions to make sure that what we thought as a professional group were the important things to keep were kept. So one important example for that is the archival federal program, which was funding all sorts of small projects in archives everywhere, was abolished altogether. And the relationship between the amount of money and the amount of good it did is extraordinary. I mean, it's really not much money for how much good it did. And this is something which should not be cut, really, and we're pretty sure of this, because it's very small compared to, you know, the kinds of cut that these people got. We are also making sure that these decisions are taken in a way which is at arm's length of politics, and because these are all institutions that are committed to some form of autonomy from, you know, partisan politics. And if that means, you know, meetings with these institutions and all that, we're trying to do this. We're not always successful, but that's the line we've adopted.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily an issue then that the Canadian Historical Association or the Canadian Historical Community is objecting to the concept of cuts. Because this is a concern I would have, that it's just a blanket rejection of any cut to history in general, because it's across the board cuts throughout the federal government and public institutions. So the concern more is doing the or making those cuts effectively and reasonably so as to not affect the core principles of historical research. Would I be right in characterizing it that way?
No, I thought the first part of my answer was not about this. I think there's a general question of where is it that if you have all these cuts to make, you know, where is it that you decide the cuts are going to be in the general budget?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the general question of should you cut at all? Now, some of that is part of party politics, is who you vote for. Some parties are more committed to spending more. And there are points at which, you know, the teaching of history and research in history is seriously jeopardized, and we have to identify these things. I think that we cannot do the job of party politics, and it's not our job to do this, but that to identify places and times when cuts might jeopardize seriously the teaching and the research and the diffusion of history, it's our job. That if so sometimes this is what cuts mean, so sometimes we have to say that cuts are not good, period.
Right.
Yes, and I think our feeling would be that the federal government has long played a critical role in supporting Canada's major institutions and programs in culture and heritage. And that's been an indispensable support to Canadian identity, to linking Canadians by our common cultural inheritance, which includes many of these programs devoted to history. There were, of course, major problems with the fiscal problems with the accumulated national debt and runaway deficits in the 1990s when we experienced these kinds of cuts before. But I don't think a convincing case has been made that we are in the dire financial situation as a country that we were in the 1990s. But leaving aside that argument, we want to encourage the continuation of the absolutely vital role of the federal government in supporting these programs that link us together as Canadians. And we see ourselves as playing a key role in advocating on behalf of Canadian identity.
I think another dimension of that, if you want to go deeper, is that most of us are involved in a way or another in researching and explaining the history of politics, right? In all, so that by teaching and researching the ways by which a government decides how to cut, where to cut, if you need to cut, historians have a larger social responsibility to make sure that citizens who make these choices in the end make them in an informed way and know in which traditions they decide to cut or not to cut and all that. But that's a more, you could say, deeper and more diffuse role of historians. But every time we meet to discuss, you know, the cuts, the present cuts and the cuts even of the former government about history, we talk about that larger role that historians have to make sure that whatever citizens discuss, they do it with the best possible knowledge of their past.
So this, you know, is part of this thing, and it seems like it's a constant struggle then for historians is to engage a wider audience and engage the public in what we do, and it's been a theme of some of the panels that I've sat in on. So how is the CHA, or what is perhaps the best means, or maybe a more effective means, through which we as a community of historians can connect to the public, inform them of the research, and inform them of the importance of maintaining funding and maintaining institutions like Library and Archives Canada so that they can be effective sources for Canadian history?
Very directly, the Canadian Historical Association has done a lot of work of advocacy. We have two people whose role it is on council out of 10 people, whose role it is to monitor these things and to write to the minister, to write to our members, to really gather knowledge about that, to really monitor what's going on, like monitor what's... They have, for instance, at Library and Archives Canada, stopped their service of interlibrary loan.
Mm-hmm.
They say it won't change anything. So
I wouldn't have been able to do my thesis as an MA student in Regina without that. Just I'll add parenthetically.
So they say that it will be replaced by other things which will do as good. So we have to make sure by asking our members and by looking around and reading to monitor if, you know, how the implementation of this is happening and the consequences, and gather the knowledge that is necessary to inform Library and Archives Canada and the minister of the consequences of that decision and of possible alternatives and of sometimes some misconceptions about how things work. So we do that very direct work of explaining things. So when they cut the program that was turning all, giving all the money to these smaller archival places, we are trying to monitor what it actually does and how sometimes it's not really replaceable and some other times it is. So as a repository of knowledge and as a kind of meeting point for knowledge, we do a lot of that. And then we produce documents and we distribute them so that people have an informed opinion. And then we do actually direct advocacy meeting and writing and to the people who are responsible to convey the problems that our members are having or the hopes or the suggestions that our members are having. At another level, and that's what a lot of people have been saying at this conference, I mean, we teach thousands and thousands of students, you know, between us.
Yeah.
And that might be our biggest outreach. It's not only that we're talking to them now, but they will be the people in the future who will be in these institutions and everything. So if or who will be in other sectors of society, but would will have a sense of what history does. And then we are trying to, at the CHA more than before, is full of public historians, people who are historians working in institutions that have another kind of relationship with the public, parks, history divisions of departments, archives in public institutions, and more amateur public history places, genealogists, and that kind of history is very often closer to the public. So that's another way by which these people are usually closer to the public. And more generally, there was at this conference and last year as well, a real wish to try to intervene publicly in newspapers, in op-eds, when possible, if and when the circumstances call for somebody to defend these institutions or inform a larger public of what's at stake.
And we've been posting a lot more material, including our communications, our representations and letters to ministers, to the Prime Minister, to the Librarian and Archivist of Canada, to other authorities on the CHA website in our section under advocacy and also on our Tumblr blog called Vox Historica, where any number of documents and communications relating to these important policy issues has been appearing. And indeed, I must give credit to Active History for helping with creating these podcasts. I think that's really helping us get our message out as well. We don't have a lot of experience in direct contact with the media, although I suspect you will see more of a media connection between the CHA and newspapers and radio stations in the future. But I would also underscore the fact that the CHA is not a political organization. Mm-hmm. It can't be partisan. Mm-hmm. But we are very much issue-oriented. So our approach has not been to challenge any particular government. It has been to challenge particular government decisions, draw out their implications, document them, and to communicate them to our members and the wider historical community what our positions are in relation to those particular issues.
So when the Canadian Association of University Teachers, CAUT, launched that large campaign to save the archives, we had to talk to see, you know, what is it that they do, what is it that we do, because many of our members are members of CAUT.
Right.
And what it is that you do as a member of the CHA and what is it that you do as a member of CAUT, it's not the same thing. CAUT has been much more aggressive and has decided to work outside of the archives. You know, they really stand outside and, you know, criticize the archives from outside. And we had a lot of discussions about it and decided that even in the hardest times recently, we were trying to, when and if it was possible, participate in the structure that Library and Archives Canada has to welcome users' input. Sometimes it's been difficult. These possibilities of interaction have considerably diminished. But to this day, we think that it's better to stay in it than to be out of it like CAUT. But other professional organizations like the archivists have decided to step out because they thought there was nothing they could do. We still think that it's better to be in, and even when it's difficult, to document how and when it's difficult and on which issues and what we've said, than to be out of it. But these are difficult decisions. It's not automatic.
Well, one of the issues then is getting the public on board getting that support from the public, because ultimately politicians are going to be responsive to, you know, swings by the public that could affect their reelectability. And I know it's not a partisan group, and that's not what I'm trying to say. It's that, you know, if you can get the public supporting history as a whole, then there might be more movement from the government. So I'm wondering, do you feel as though historians as a group are as active as they can be in communities getting public support and trying to let people understand what it is that we do? Because the sense that I've gotten just as a grad student is from some of my friends and some of my parents' friends is that, why are you studying history? What's the point of it? There's no use to it. So if that's the mindset that people are expressing to me, then indirectly politicians could say, well, I mean, the historical community's not doing anything, they're not really contributing anything. So how can we counter that perception by the public and then consequently by politicians?
I don't know, it's a complicated one, that because there was no end of panels this time around where people were saying, every time I show up in such a community and I say, I'm scared that I'm going to offend them and I'm going to see them like this person who's coming. And very often they say, we want our history to be written. You know, can you do this for that? Can you do this for us? So that the public doesn't care for history is a bit of a blanket statement. It depends how you ask that question. But generally, when you arrive somewhere, or especially for historians that do more recent things, but even for historians who do things that are a bit older, people are quite thirsty for the knowledge of the past of their place or of their kin or of their country. And especially amongst minorities, maybe people whose past is less well known, the idea that, you know, having more historical knowledge is empowering is quite prevalent. So at that level, I don't think that historians are seen as irrelevant. I suppose there is the idea that they are there researching, you know, in these good-looking campuses like this one and having it easy, really, and maybe we shouldn't pay for them. That I think might be a prejudice. And you know, you have to, I mean, teaching lots of students should do something for this, and people will be teachers and don't think that kind of stuff. But there is always some space for more public intervention and more direct public engagement. And some of our colleagues do more of that. Some of them do less of that. And when you do medieval history, you have to do that at another level. It's not, you know, that people will want, the monks are not there anymore to ask for their history. But there are so many ways by which my medieval colleagues are able to tell you that this is where we invented, you know, the clock, really, the scheduled life. And this is where the first, you know, walls and life within walls and these questions of control of social lives begin. And for them, you talk to them, everything began in a monastery. So, and they are quite good at showing that, and also at showing how passion for medieval novels, films, and all that, and to teach around these fashions and to use them as a way to go back and explore the Middle Ages. So they are more than, you know, op-eds and all that, ways to make sure that history is important. But it's not a crash thing to do. It's a slow-moving thing in many ways, I think.
Yeah, I feel there was a time, a generation or two ago, when you saw a stronger tradition of so-called public intellectuals, whether historians or specialists in other disciplines, contributing to public policy debates through articles in newspapers or appearing on TV. And we're in this period now with the 24-hour news cycle and so much emphasis on electronic media, which is influence the print media to be much focused on a a much shorter time frame, and indeed, in many cases, to be short-sighted in terms of drawing out the larger implications of these stories. One thing historians are very well positioned to do is to give the kind of context that it really is needed in order to understand many of these public policy issues more fully. And I hope some way can be found to see more historians writing those kinds of contextual issue-oriented newspaper articles or in providing interviews to radio and TV. I don't know to what degree the media now is interested in soliciting them, and I don't know what role the CHA might play, but I do think it's something we should be thinking about, because there's a lot of important knowledge and skills of analysis which I think is not being fully exploited that really could contribute to thoughtful discussion in Canada.
But if you want to talk about public intellectuals, that's what I do, the history of the state, right? So you also have these people who were actually for a while in their career working for the state, you know,
yes.
who were chairing royal commissions or becoming high bureaucrats, and wrote about the border between, you know, academic freedom and political work or bureaucratic work. And there were times where the state, working for the state, was more prestigious and more central to public life than it is now. We're in times of a shrinking state, and we've been in that time for more than the Harper government. And it makes working for a public institution a much less prestigious thing than it used to be. I mean, the apotheosis of this is wartime, where all these intellectuals for a dollar a day went, you know, lend their service to the Canadian state and the British state and the federal, the American state. And these are times of, you know, very close, for better or for worse, relationship between intellectuals and governments. And at that time, the thirst for ideas and new ways of seeing things was a very real and urgent one. Whereas now, you know, all the cuts also mean that the salaries for people like that are lower, the prestige of these jobs is smaller, the turnover is faster. So that somebody who's very well trained as a lawyer or a historian or a political scientist is more likely to end up outside of government than before. So that makes for a harder, the door is not as open as it was for public intellectuals that way.
So in a sense then, do historians almost need to reclaim their voice in the public debate or in the public consciousness? Or would that be too broad a statement?
No, I think historians are always a bit imperialist. You always want to, you know, the more the better, but it's a much more broad discussion. But I think just judging by debates of the last, I've been closer to the CHA for the last 2 years, I think a lot of historians are willing and eager to show that in all the ways we've just mentioned, that historians can contribute to public life.
Because, well, Lyle, you mentioned like that historians can provide this context to issues and provide a point of view that can help inform debates on modern issues. And I think that's something that gets lost, and something that I tried to explain to people, like my friends or family, that we're not isolated in the past. Yes, I studied the 1930s, but the 1930s can help inform other issues today, particularly recently economic issues and how we respond to these issues. So how can an institution or an organization like the CHA or even, you know, universities or individual historians, what sort of strategies do you think are out there that can help us come back to that prominent place and be active participants in these discussions? Because I like the idea of, you mentioned the blogging and the different sites that the CHA has now, and putting out all the advocacy and being transparent in that respect, and that anyone can go find what the CHA is doing with this respect. And that's one way to do it. But I'm wondering if there's other strategies, other things that you might pursue now.
You don't lose sight of the fact that the CHA actually sometimes fights for very historians, you know, centered demands. You know, that if the archives are better or are not shrinking, if the funding is better or not shrinking, if the class sizes are smaller, if the funding for students is better, our profession thrives, right? So
yeah.
We're fighting for very specific things that have to do with the conditions of our work and our teaching and our students, and more largely of all the business of showing history in parks, in museums, and in public institutions. So that's a very close, you know, and important place. And if we don't do it, not many people will do this. So, and to convince the public that these institutions have a meaning and are important, if and when the public needs to be, that's very important. But more generally on the importance of history, I think if you go on the website of Library and Archives Canada, there is no history of Library and Archives Canada on the website. You know, about us.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's all about the future. There is not, and the present. There is nothing about the past. And I was in this session about archives and with Jared Henderson doing something about one of the national archivists to really shape the institution, Doughty. And so I was trying to find on my computer, you know, is he there somewhere? I mean, he's got a statue and everything, but I don't think he's on the website. I don't think you have the list of you don't even have the list of the national archivists. So I'm always pushing when I see any website, you know, and there is no history, to say, come on, it's written somewhere. Why don't you put that on your website so that people go and read these things? Sometimes, again, I always find, like, I'm writing the history of Oxfam, and they don't have the time to do their history. They're just too busy doing the next thing. But when you tell them it's there and, you know, I can put it on your website, and they love it, right? They want to know their history. So, but then on the general debate, it's very important. This is where if, you know, the next thing is about radio, you've got to find ways to say, you know, what I'm studying, you know, on radio will tell you that we've done that before and it's not worked, but maybe it's not worked because of that, or other people in other places have done that and that seemed to be working very well. I mean, it's really an exercise in best practice. You know, there is this wonderful article about why study history by Peter Stern, I think, where he says that's the only lab we've got, right? Our past. I mean, we don't have a lab in social life because we cannot, you know, do these experiments that they do in other disciplines, but we've got this massive laboratory of the past. You've got to be careful because, no variable is independent and everything, but you really have a repository of knowledge about all sorts of things. And if you are able to spot the moment where it becomes meaningful, then it's almost your duty, I think, to come up with it more forcefully.
Just thinking aloud, it strikes me that if we were positioned by virtue of having a little more time to devote to some proactive building of capacity for advocacy work, we might consider looking at developing lists of historians with particular kinds of expertise, whether it relate to constitutional issues or perhaps historic sites or our archival policy or those kinds of things. So we could have perhaps a stable of people that could be drawn upon at fairly short notice to comment on some of these important issues. We have been so busy, preoccupied with responding to the rapid pace of cuts and changes in government programs over the last year since the 2012 budget that we've barely had enough time to come up for air. I think we've done as good a job as we possibly could in responding to these issues, but perhaps some thought could be devoted to positioning ourselves to be a little more proactive, given the fact we may need to this kind of rapid response. Of course, when you put forward experts or suggestions to media organizations, they have to also come to the table. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I don't know in the current climate to what degree the media outlets are interested in that kind of advice, but I think all we could do is perhaps try to help them out so that we are contributing more fully to an informed public policy debate.
But, I mean, since we are on radio here, over that year, we received lots of email of, you know, anybody, you know, some of my graduate students, some of my undergraduate students, some some historians saying, have you seen that article? Have you seen that radio? Have you heard that radio program? Look what they're doing in Britain. Look at that YouTube video. So what we've been doing, we have, I don't remember one time when we said rubbish. You know, we've either asked our executive director to put it on the Tumblr site because we're not responsible for the content of the Tumblr site, but we could post all sorts of things. I mean, unless it's really offensive, we monitor it, but we post all sorts of things to keep the discussion going. If it's some stuff that is directly relevant to what we're doing, then between members of the executive and the council, we've circulated that on a daily basis. And so far, maybe one day it won't be possible, but we were able to circulate that stuff all the time. So we've been taking all these inputs seriously. Very often we've thanked the people, we've asked them for more. I mean, the exchange with the members and, you know, the kind of close public has been very open, and I think we've been responsive. I think.
Yes, and as I understand it, and I've seen quite a bit of evidence of this, the Vox Historica Tumblr account has been extremely well received by our members and others in the historical community. So we feel that has been a major step forward, and indeed the posting of our communications on our main webpage. But perhaps we could be thinking about other ways to expand our reach.
And another thing which is interesting is that one of the problems, the recurring problems of the CHA, is how it gathers much more historians of Canada than historians of other places. But the CHA is the Association of Historians Working in Canada. So if you do the Historian of Southeast Asia, it's also right. Your professional association, because we're the only ones who's going to fight with the shirk, who's going to fight with or fight or talk to, you know, governments who are talking about university funding or museum funding. Because of all that advocacy work, historians who very often don't really know, you know, what is the CHA doing for me, as citizens and as historians whose, you know, work is sometimes in some sectors endangered, they have come to the CHA more willingly than they were in the past, because that aspect of the work of the CHA has been showing more in the recent months.
For listeners out there, people who are concerned about this, I mean, what do you think as individuals, what do you think the best way in which people can address some of their concerns over the cuts and what's going on surrounding historical research in Canada? You know, people want to mobilize, I think, especially in the community, in the sense that I'm getting around the conference this week, but some people don't know how to do that. So how would you suggest might be the best way for people to become active in voicing their concerns?
Well, first of all, if there are issues or aspects to these particular controversies that they think need to be drawn to our attention, we encourage certainly all our members or anyone concerned about the practice of history to get in touch with our national office in Ottawa. And our executive director has been very good at sharing those communications with members of our executive on a pretty rapid basis. And we do try to respond to those concerns in the best way and in as timely a way as possible. So I think the first step is to get in touch with us, and I think it's fair to say we take any and all concerns seriously when they're drawn to our attention.
I think one of the things maybe these people you're talking about would find reassuring is that for questions that have to do with historical practice, the CHA is glad to centralize advocacy. I mean, we don't want to be the only ones to do that, but if they don't know where to go, they can go to the CHA with the insurance that the CHA would listen and bring that into the folder that has to do with the archives, with the library, with SHRC, or with university funding, or with, you know, cutting the Canadian Studies program abroad. They would be listened to, and they can be sure that the two advocacy people and the council behind them will use that for public representation. So if they feel lonely, that's a good place to go. But if they want to do something around their place about it, they can ask the CHA for information, or for somebody to come and speak, or, you know, they can ask the opposite. Otherwise, there are things that are happening locally that are very important. You don't need the CHE to do what the archives of the city of Ottawa have done. You know, they hosted a big meeting on the situation of the archives, and it was a local meeting. They had people from the CHA there, but it was a local meeting, and we knew what was going on, and we published what they were doing. But it was also a more local event, and that there are things happening locally that have to be discussed locally. And so I'm sure the CHA can certainly make feel people that they're not alone and provide some tools and advice if somebody wants to organize something, because we've seen so many things being organized. We could even say, well, you look, they've done this in Vancouver, they've done this in Ottawa, you know.
Now, in the interest of getting a balanced picture, we did send an email to the to James Moore, the Canadian Minister of Heritage, and they declined our interview request, but they did send a statement regarding the cuts at historical institutions. And here it is, quote, "This government is delivering to give Canadians greater access to its history more than any other previous government. On the issue of the preservation of our country's history, our government strongly believes in ensuring the preservation of our documentary and historical heritage. Library and Archives Canada is becoming more efficient while also improving services. In fact, now all Canadians will be able to access our historical content online, not just researchers in Ottawa. The Library and Archives Modernization Initiative will improve and expand access to Canada's documentary and cultural heritage for all Canadians, regardless of their profession or location. Our government recognizes the importance of Library and Archives Canada and the many services it provides, as it plays an essential role in preserving the documentary heritage of Canada. As a departmental agency, the responsibility for operational decisions lies with the Deputy Head and Librarian and Archivist of Canada. Under his stewardship, LAC is modernizing its operations and changing its organizational structure in order to increase digital services and programming for the benefit of Canadians. LAC has never ceased to make key acquisitions, as this priority is clearly set out in its mandate. Every year, LAC acquires thousands of items from private fonds and an average of 100,000 publications, and more recently, an average of 60,000 digital publications. For example, LAC just recently acquired the first complete and authorized version of the Bible to be published in Canada, a book dating back to the 1830s. LAC is developing a new model to ensure that they make the right decisions at the time in order that Canada's documentary heritage is acquired and preserved for future generations. Through this approach, LAC is concentrating more extensively on obtaining all socially relevant content rather than acquiring objects taken out of content." And that statement was provided prior to Daniel Caron's resignation. So when he refers to the Deputy Head and Library and Archivist of Canada, that is to whom the statement is referring. So my thanks from the minister for the statement. Also, Dominique Marshall, now president of the Canadian Historical Association from Carleton University. Thank you. Lyle Dick, now past president. What are you going to do now? You're done. It's got to be a bit of a relief to have this presidency over with. Maybe some more free time for some of your own projects. Or does it feel good?
It feels good, yeah. But
did you sleep better last night?
maybe a little bit better. But I'm still on the executive as past president another year, and I am here to help Dominique however she sees fit for another year. Looking forward to it.
Terrific. Well, thank you both for doing this.
Thank you.
I appreciate
it.
If anybody has any comments, questions for the podcast, as always, historyslam@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter at Dr. Shawnee Fever. As always, if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Check out activehistory.ca for more features and articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.